I'm going to ask an old familiar question. I'm going to add a little bit to it, but we've heard this many, many times before. Why are we here eating the bread of affliction? Why are we here eating the bread of affliction? After all, most of the rest of the Christian world or professing Christian world is out doing fun stuff at this time of year. They're concerned about beautiful new dresses and great bonnets and hats and new shoes. And all those things are nice, all those things are good. They're concerned about bunnies hopping around, little rabbits hopping around, laying eggs, no less. And colored eggs at that. Candy. I think that this season is the second most, it's either the second or third most. I don't know about Halloween, but Christmas is the number one candy holiday, and either Easter or Halloween are the second most candy is sold. I guess I could find out a little bit because I work at a company where we sell candy for all kinds of occasions, including at those seasons. But candy, another fun thing. Something else that's a fun thing to do. You know, everybody pretty much likes candy. I don't eat as much. I still like it, but I don't eat quite as much as I used to. Maybe I've gotten a little wiser. But at any rate, candy is a popular item with almost everybody, even for those who can't have sugar. We've made a whole big industry of making sugar-free or sugarless candy so that they can enjoy it as well. And then this may be the only time of the year that some people get up before the sun. They get out there to watch the sunrise and to worship the sun, as it were, as the sun comes up, sunrise. But here we are eating, as I said, the bread of affliction. Notice in Deuteronomy, the 16th chapter. Deuteronomy 16. And for those who may not know what the bread of affliction is, it's the hard bread that's unleavened. And a lot of it is a little bit tasteless. Now, we can make it tasteful if we want to. We can spread butter and honey or jelly or on it. And I know we had people here that sometimes used to take matzos and cover them with chocolate. And that makes them a lot better, obviously. Or, you know, just some, we can get egg and onion matzos, salted, unsalted, all kinds of them, like a lot of things. But they're not as tasty as some of the other candies that we could get or some of the other breads especially that we could get. Because bread is one of the staples of life. But, of course, we remember the admonition that man shall not live by bread alone. And if all we had was matzos, I'm thinking that would be easier to do than it is now. But Deuteronomy 16, where we were for the offering, we'll read the first three verses. Observe the month of Abib, and the month of Abib is the first month of the year. Exodus, the 12th chapter, you can go there and figure that out. The first month of the year, I think it means green ears or something like that. And keep the Passover to the Lord your God, for in the month of Abib, the Lord your God brought you out of Egypt by night. Therefore, you shall sacrifice the Passover. Now, the Passover itself, we observed two nights ago on Tuesday night, but it's the term Passover is used for the whole unleavened bread season or for the Passover lamb or for Jesus Christ. It's used in more than one way. You shall sacrifice the Passover to the Lord your God from the flock and the herd in the place where the Lord chooses to put his name. you shall eat no leavened bread with it. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread with it. That is the bread of affliction. And that's where that term comes from, the bread of affliction. For you came out of the land of Egypt in haste, and of course we probably know the story that way they came out of Egypt by night, didn't have time to let their bread rise, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute here, but that's where the term came from. The term Passover came from Exodus 12, was the first recorded Passover, and that's why it's called the hard bread or the bread of affliction, because it's not nice and soft, and it's not chewy, and it's not, when you, just give you a little idea. I have three, well, I shouldn't say I do, but we have three little dogs. When my mother-in-law died, we inherited two more. We already had one. And we never should have let him in the house, because once you get attached to him, you just can't get rid of him. But in the morning, every morning, I have my cup of coffee. And we buy these little, they're called Stroop waffles or Dutch syrup waffles or whatever. They're a little cookie with caramel in between them, sandwiched in between them. I take that and I put it on top of my coffee. It softens it up and it's real good. But since we had this dog, these three dogs, I don't get any anymore, because they have learned that every time I get a bite, they need one. But now there's not enough bites to go around, so I'm giving it all to them. Well, guess what? Today, the days of unleavened bread started, and now what did the dogs get? They got unleavened bread. And I don't think they were very, very happy about it, but because they kept sitting there, they're little dogs, kept sitting there in my room and just staring at me. Like, what's this? Well, they're going to have to get used to it for a few days. But the thing about, the reason I mention this is when you break off a little piece, crumbs go flying everywhere. Unlike the other cookies I gave to them, this is pretty messy and pretty crumbly. But so be it. We'll put up with it till we get something else. And that'll be in a week. There are... we alluded to Easter here a minute ago, and I'm not going to go into much detail about Easter itself and talk about why people do what they do for Easter, all the observances and all the things that are attached to it. But in this month, or actually it's this last period, March and April, issue of Beyond Today magazine, there are some really good, hard-hitting, in-depth articles about the things that are attached to Easter. And you, if you get a chance, if you haven't, you should read it, read some of them, because there is some interesting information there that will help us to better understand why we should or shouldn't participate in Easter. And it's like, what is... not sure what that was. I don't think it was me. I think it was from the back. At any rate, what is Easter masking, or what is what are the symbols involved in it? What is the what are the idols that are attached to it? And by the way, I wanted to thank the fellow Lewis Pettit who gave the sermonette, because he did a real good job of setting up what I want to talk about. But you can go to the Beyond Today magazine and read those articles, and it'll inform you of a lot of things. But are we, with these days, the days of unleavened bread, are we just stuck in some kind of a time warp where we are doing these Old Testament Jewish forms of worship? Or what's happening here? Well, God anticipated these questions. And in Deuteronomy 6, turning back just 10 chapters, Deuteronomy 6, verse 20 and 24, he said, when your son asks you in time to come, or your son could be representative of when your neighbor asks you, or when your father asks you, or when another relative asks you, when anybody asks you in time to come, saying, what is the meaning of the testimonies, the statutes, and the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded you? He says what to do. In verse 24, the Lord commanded us to observe all these things for this reason, to fear the Lord our God for our good always. Now, you know, eating unleavened bread, matzos, maybe it's good for you. It's probably not as fattening as some of the other bread, soft bread, big loaves that we might get, or the buns that we eat and so forth. But I don't know. Probably the biggest reason we don't eat as much of it is because it's just not as good. But nonetheless, we are to have an answer when somebody asks us, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? The King James says something to the order of, what means this? What means this? And that, I've chosen that as the title for my message, what means this? Are these just meaningless rituals that we do? And I think we have to be careful at times that we don't just take them as that, meaningless ritual. Oh yeah, I gotta eat unleavened bread. But probably when we do that, as we did at Passover, when we take that unleavened bread, we should think about the meaning of it and the reason for it. And obviously we need to know that. But why do we have to do that every year? Couldn't God have just said, unleavened bread represents sin, and let it go at that? Why did he involve us in it and so forth? For that matter, he could have done that with all the commandments and everything, and we have a little thin pamphlet instead of this thick Bible that we have. And we could have just, okay. So why do we need to do these things every year? I was listening to a Church of God minister recently, and he said something that made a lot of sense to me that I had never thought of before. He said the reason that we need to do these things over and over and over is that God is too brilliant for us to get these things at one time. Just to get it, to do it once and get it one time, or twice, or many times, or even a lifetime. We won't get it all probably in a lifetime. Eventually, hopefully, we will get it in its completeness after we have made it into God's kingdom and after we have become spirit beings. But God is too brilliant for us to get this all at once. And I thought that was a rather interesting statement that I hadn't considered before. And it's probably very true. All these things are set in life circumstances and situations so that we can understand it better. Think about this. Abraham was called to sacrifice his son, Isaac, which, by the way, was probably at the Passover unleavened bread season, when you read all the things around it and consider how it was done and what it was done and so forth. But he was asked to sacrifice his son. And I can identify with Abraham possibly having to lose his son in that manner better than I can with God sacrificing his son, because it's on a more human term to me and probably to many of us. It's easier to understand, and that's why all the things that we read of and read in the Bible are set in physical life circumstances, so that, and again, we're not going to get it all at one time, but so that over the years, through time, circumstances, experience, and so on, that we can understand these things more completely, better, they make more sense to us, and we can incorporate them into our life better. If God had just said, you shall not bear false witness, and left it at that, it would be a lot harder to understand than it is when he told the people who died there in Acts, when that happened. Then we could understand it a little bit more. And some of the other circumstances and situations that we find false witness, we can understand better because they're in a life application situation. Leviticus 23, we certainly want to go there. It's probably the one most often used place where all the holy days are written for us. And we'll read verse 2 and then 4 to 8. Verse 2 says, speak, and he's talking to Moses, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, the feasts of the Lord, the feasts of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts. These are the feasts of the Lord. Verse 4. Now, I'm going to stop there just for a minute, and let's notice. These are the feasts of the Lord. They're not the feasts of Moses. They're not the feasts of Israel. They're not the feast of the Jews. In fact, the Jews did not come about till many, many years after this was written, and we don't really read about Jews as such. They're only mentioned first in 2 Kings 16:6, and at that point, they were fighting with Israel. Now, the King James uses Jews. I think the New King James might say Judah, but nonetheless, Jews were not in play at this point, not for a long time to come. But it also says that we are proclaimed to call out, to announce, pronounce, to publish these in their season. Let's go on. On the 14th day of the first month, the twilight is the Passover, the Lord's Passover. On the 15th day of the first month is the Feast of Unleavened Bread to the Lord. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work on it. And that, my margin says, no occupational work on that day. You shall offer an offering made by fire. On the seventh day shall be a holy convocation, and you shall not do any customary work on it either. But again, let's point out verse 6. And the one thing there, it says 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. When we follow this thread through, we find out that before the feast, Passover, and up till yesterday, we were supposed to put out leavening from our homes. But the focus in a subtle way shifts a little bit after this. And it says now we must, you shall, we are to put unleavened bread into our life. It's a little different than just putting leavening out all the days of the Feast of Tabernacles, the days of unleavened bread, which obviously, if we find any at that point, we are to remove that as well. But that's no longer as much of an emphasis as it is to bring unleavened bread into our life. It has shifted in just a subtle way. There's Exodus 34, we won't go there. I'll give you three references if you want to write them down. Exodus 34, 18, Numbers 28, 17, Exodus 16, 3, which we already read. These are the places where it says that you shall or you must eat unleavened bread for 7 days. But let's go to Exodus, the 12th chapter, for just a little more detail on this. Exodus 12, and we'll read 15 to 20. In verse 15 of Exodus 12, and this is, of course, where it really all begins, when they are, this is leading up to Passover night and then on beyond, where the Israelites are leaving the land of Egypt by night and so on. But it said in verse 15, 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall remove leaven from your houses, for whoever eats leavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. On the first day again there shall be a holy convocation, and on the seventh day there shall be a holy convocation for you. No manner of work shall be done on them, but that which everyone must eat, that only may be prepared for by you. Now there, that's a little bit, another subtle difference from the regular Sabbath, which we're not to do any work. And the reason I think for it is because here we sometimes don't have a choice but to fix a meal, where on the Sabbath we can do a little more to prepare for it in advance. So you shall observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread, for on the same day I will have brought your armies out of the land of Egypt. Therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generations as an everlasting ordinance. On the first day of the month, on the 14th day of the month at evening, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month at evening. For 7 days, no leavening shall be found in your houses. In verse 20, you shall eat nothing leavened in all your dwellings. You must eat, or you shall eat unleavened bread. Now, one of the reasons I wanted to go into this in just a little bit more depth and give a little more detail. This is the first holy day of the year for us, the plan of God being explained again. And I wanted us to have a good foundation for the plan of God going forward. Now, a little bit of background, additional background. And for that, we'll go back to Leviticus, the 23rd chapter. Because there are some things here that are easily missed, let's say. In verse 2, which we already read, it said that these are the feasts of the Lord. The word that's used there is moed, or if it's plural, it would be moedim or moeds. And it's the Strong's number 4150. And 40, it's always easy when you have a number, because then you can go to that number in Strong's. You don't have to try and memorize a word or try to figure out how to pronounce a word and so forth, which I'm not very good at. And but that word means appointment or appointed times. Appointment or appointed times. Dropping down again to verse 4, again. Well, let's finish up in verse 2. The feasts of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my appointed times. These are my appointed times. Then verse 4. These are the appointments or the feasts of the Lord, holy convocations, which you shall proclaim at their, and here's the same word, appointed times. Here it was actually translated as appointed times. But this is not the first place that this word has been used. Before we'll go there, well, let's turn back to Genesis 1. Genesis, the first chapter. The fourth day is being created. God is creating, and he created here the fourth day, Genesis 1, verse 14. He said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and appointed times. Signs and appointed times. Signs and season is how it was translated here, but it's that same word, and it means appointed times. Way back very beginning, these appointed times began. God took the time to have this put down on paper for us so that we can see this, and it gives us an indication that the appointed times, the feasts, go back further than even the Exodus. Now, what the Passover meant at that point before then is not exactly clear. But we do know that Abraham kept God's commandments, his statutes, and his laws, which would have included these days, And there are hints that Abraham and Lot kept unleavened bread. We find that in Genesis 18 and 19, when Abraham was visited by the messengers from God that then went from there to Sodom and Gomorrah to find out for themselves, is this as bad as we think it is, as a report that has come up to us? Now, you'd think that God could know that without coming down, but God wanted boots on the ground. He wanted to see firsthand, personally, what it was, and there are indications that at that particular time that might have been at the spring holy day season. You have to read the whole context and everything. Both Abraham and Lot gave these messengers unleavened bread. It was in the spring of the year. There were other things going on that would indicate that these probably were at the festival season. Seemed like most of the things that God did, the important big things that he did, such as the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, happened around his holy days. Whether it was the Feast of Tabernacles or the Day of Pentecost, which we can read about in Acts 2, or whether it was any other announcements that he made, seem to have happened, if we look carefully, on holy days. There's one thing that is also often overlooked, Matthew, the 25th chapter. It's part of the Sermon on the Mount. And it actually is a part of, or right after, the parable of the talents. It's right after the parable of the talents, and it's in verse 34. And what it is talking about, 31, when the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the holy angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory, and he will judge the nations. All the nations will be gathered to him, and he will divide the sheep from the goats. In verse 34, he says, then the king will say to those on his right hand, come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. In other words, going all the way back to the beginning, this kingdom was prepared for those who were going to inherit them. Now, if the holy days show God's plan, which they do, then they too must have been from the beginning, because this is the kingdom of God, and they must have, for that plan to have been in place, the holy days must also have been in place from the beginning, or from the foundation of the world. Galatians 3:8 said God preached the gospel to Abraham all the way back then, the gospel to Abraham. In Genesis 4, with Cain and Abel, we see that there was already a system of sacrifice in place right from the beginning. Cain and Abel were the first a couple of sons of Adam and Eve after they had been put out of the Garden of Eden. Cain and Abel were, Cain was a grain farmer, and Abel was a livestock farmer. God had respect to Abel's sacrifice, and if there was no system of sacrifice in place, then it wouldn't have mattered. It wouldn't have, who would have cared? Who would have cared if how Abel sacrificed and how Cain sacrificed? Wouldn't have been a difference, wouldn't have mattered. Malachi 3:6 said, I am God, I change not. Let's just go there. It's the last book, just a little bit back. It's the last book of the Old Testament before we get to the book of Matthew. And the first line says, "For I am the Lord, I do not change." Hebrews said, 13 verse 8, that he is the same yesterday, today, and forever. James says, James 1, 17, that there is no variation or no shadow of turning with God. The reason this is important is because God never changes. When he puts something in place, which he did way back then, the appointed times, he doesn't change it. We can depend on God. We can know that God, that this is permanent, this is what God did, and it's not going to change. We don't come to the first month of Abib on the 15th day and find out, oh, unleavened bread's no longer there. What happened? It doesn't work like that. It's always there. It's there every year. It's been there from the beginning. God had put it there or instituted it for us to observe. But why would God even be worried, or why would he be concerned, or why would there be an issue with us? Why would he want to meet us and have appointments with us? I know some of you are in business, many of you are probably, and you make an appointment, and I'm sure you have a system to make sure that you don't miss this appointment, whether you have a day timer and with pages, or whether you use your phone and have bells and whistles and whatnot pop up and tell you, hey, tomorrow you have a meeting with so-and-so. Or however you do it, we have a system. We have a way to make sure that we do not miss these appointments. We generally even have maybe a paper, a white paper, or whatever you want to call it, with bullet points that this is what we want to accomplish at this meeting. This is the reason for the meeting, and this is why. And I know that's what I do at the place I work. There are places, now sometimes I don't make an appointment with everybody I go to see, but the most important appointments I do, I line them up maybe days or weeks or even months in advance so that I make sure that I don't miss that appointment and that I don't, especially a real important appointment, that I don't get there at the wrong time, or that I don't come and I'm not prepared, or that I don't come and I don't have a paper that tells me what we're going to be talking about and so forth, or the person the appointment is with will have that sometimes as well. But why would God think it's so important for us to have an appointment with him, so important that he put it in the very first chapter of the Bible in the creation account? That's what we want to look at here in just a couple of minutes, or for the next few minutes. In Deuteronomy, the 14th chapter, there's an important indication of why that is. Deuteronomy 14, and in verse 23. Now here, this is probably specifically about the Feast of Tabernacles, but it could be any of the feasts. It could be the Feast of Unleavened Bread, or it could be the Feast of Pentecost, and so forth. But it says in verse 23, "You shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide, the tithes of your grain, your new wine, your oil, and of the firstborn of your herds and your flocks." And here's why. Here's why he made these appointments. "That you may learn to fear." That you may learn. It's to teach us. It's for teaching is why God wants us to keep these appointments with him. So we can learn things. So we can know what to do. So that we can know what to expect of him and what he can expect of us. We made a covenant at baptism with God that we would perform certain functions and God would perform certain functions. And that's why when we come together at the Passover, we sort of renew our commitment to doing that. And that's why God does it every year. Because we need to know that we're on track, that we're still doing what we're supposed to do and what God expects of us. Again, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always, constantly, every day, all the time. Now, I know we fail. At least I do. And there are times when we don't live up to our commitment like we should, or like I should anyway. But doesn't mean we don't keep trying and we don't keep going. That only means that we need to try harder, that we need to rededicate ourselves, that we need to be more diligent in what we are doing. And again, these are teaching appointments. That's why they were made. That's why God wanted us to do them. 1 Corinthians 10, 1 to 12. This is a place we read often. 1 Corinthians 10. Here's a little summary or recap of what, and we'll go from 1 to 12. A little summary or a little bit of a recap as to what, I think we're getting a visitor, as to what exactly this was all about, why all these things are written, and as I mentioned before, that these things are written in a context so it's easier for us to understand. And as we read this, we'll see that. Brethren, he said, this is Paul writing to the Corinthians, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea. In other words, they also were baptized. All ate the same spiritual food. They all ate that same spiritual food that we also ingest. And all drank the same spiritual drink. Well, I thought it was physical food, manna and water from the rock and so on. But they also had, there was another side to that. They also got spiritual food and spiritual input from God. And all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. That's another little nugget or tidbit that a lot of people don't realize or understand, that Jesus Christ was the God of the Old Testament, and he was the one who brought the Egyptians, or the Israelites, out of Egypt and crossed the Red Sea and into the wilderness and was with them. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. 40 years they were trampling around out there in what should have taken them maybe 14 days to get from Egypt to Canaan. And they went around in circles for 40 years because they couldn't obey, because they just were hard-headed and stubborn. And I don't know that I should even stand here and say that about them, because it applies to me and it applies to us as well, I'm sure. How much better we would have done, I don't know. But I want to think I would have, but I'm not sure always that I would have. But their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. And here is a key point. These things became our examples to the intent that we should not do the same thing they did, that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. They did things that they should not have done. They came out of Egypt, and right away they took their gold earrings and took all these things and threw them into the fire, and guess what popped out? A golden calf. That's what Aaron told Moses, that, hey, we threw this gold in there, and up popped this idol, this golden calf. just by a miracle, I guess. But we are not supposed to do that. And here we have it written, and this will help us. If we could learn from others' mistakes, we would be so much better off. And we do. We read these things and we try, but we're not always as successful, at least I'm not, as I wish I was. He said, "Do not become idolaters," verse 7, "as some of them were, as it is written. The people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play," and that's in the golden calf incident. "Nor let us commit sexual immorality, as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 of them fell." "Nor let us tempt Christ," and again, Christ must have been there for them to tempt him, "as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents." Every time I read that, I think of that scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark where the Harrison Ford falls into the snake pit. And it just makes me shiver because I hate snakes. But that's what he said here, that they were destroyed by serpents. "Nor complain, as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer." Again, he repeats, all these things happened to them as examples, and that's why they're written here, as examples to me, as examples to us. And they were written for our admonition or our instructions. That's why they were written. "Upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." Take him who thinks he stands, take heed lest he fall. Make sure we're on solid foundation, solid ground. 1 Corinthians, the fifth chapter, has more to say about the details of the days of unleavened bread. 1 Corinthians 5. And the book of 1 Corinthians, as most students of the Bible and commentators recognize and acknowledge, was written during or for the Passover and the days of unleavened bread. And we can see that. We can see glimpses of that all through the book from the first chapter to the last chapter as we read it. And if that's in our mind, we can pick up on that. There was a problem there in that church, Corinthians. And these, remember, were Gentiles. It is actually reported, he said in verse 5, or chapter 5, verse 1, that there is sexual immorality among you, and such immorality as is not even named among the Gentiles. Must have been pretty corrupt and pretty bad. That a man has his father's wife. And, he says, you are puffed up about it. They're arrogant about it. They are proud of their tolerance. Why, look at us. We're so proud of this transgender thing, and we're so proud of, you know, we have, who knows, we know somebody, and we're so proud of them for standing up for what they believe in, or we're so proud of that same-sex marriage that occurred, that took place in someone we know, and I do know some people who are in same-sex marriages, and yeah, look how tolerant we are. Why, we're glad to associate with them and bring them into our group and be associated with them. That's what he's saying here. That's what happened here. You are puffed up and haven't rather mourned that he who has done this deed might be taken away from you. They were willing to let this person in their congregation or to stay in their congregation. Dropping down to verse 6, it says, "Your glorying," or this arrogance, or this puffed up, or this tolerance, "is not good. Don't you know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump?" Now, this sounds maybe a little strange to us, but what they did in those days, they used sourdough, and each batch of sourdough had to take a little bit of a lump of it out and keep it back for their next batch to be able to ferment or to make it rise for the next batch of sourdough bread to rise, so they had to keep that back. And that's what he's saying here, that little lump, don't you know that that little lump leavens the whole big batch of bread? We can sometimes find in you know, any associations we're in, let's just pick an example of work. Sometimes at work we'll have somebody that for some reason he just seems to sour the whole group. Never can be pleased, or he always has to be off the wall, or he has to be different, or he has to be agitating, or that person, male or female, I shouldn't say just he, but they have to be the ones that stir up the pot, so to speak. They have to be the lump that leavens the whole group. And that happens at work. It happens in families. It happens everywhere. It happens in church. It can happen to us here. Therefore, he says, Paul, purge out or throw out, clean out the old leaven that you may be a new lump. Because every time when the Feast of Unleavened Bread and Passover came around, they had to throw the old leaven out. Then they had to start with a new lump. They had to make let it ferment, and that took a few days for that to happen. Since you truly, he said, therefore, I'll start over. Therefore, purge out the old leaven that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. Because they had unleavened for the days of unleavened bread. For indeed, Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. He contrasts the sinful old nature with the new nature of sincerity and truth. And he asks them to do that. There's a book in the Bible that I think is maybe almost the most appropriate book to read. And I would encourage you to sometime during these days of unleavened bread to take the time to read this particular book. And it's John, the 6th chapter. And it's all about the bread and the bread of life. And it's at the Passover season. It says so in verse 4 of chapter 6. Now the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. So we know the context and the setting of this was the Feast of Unleavened Bread, or the Days of Unleavened Bread. And it's we won't read the whole chapter, but we'll pick out a few verses here. Dropping over to 29, Christ had just fed 5,000 men as well as women and children with five loaves, barley loaves, and a few fishes. And it was, even the people where it happened to, they realized that a notable miracle had taken place here, because they knew there was no food, but Jesus Christ, being of that Middle Eastern culture, had the means to do it, so he fed the people. He fed the people. But all that does, whenever, and I'm sure we're the same way, if we saw a miracle, what we want to do is see another one. And it would never end. We would just want to see more and more and more, which is what they wanted. And he eventually had to distance himself from this group of people, because they were going to come try to make him, because of this miracle, they were going to try and make him a king, which it was not the time for that. It wasn't going to happen. So he slipped away, and when they found him on the other side of the sea, because he had slipped to the other side of the sea, they said to him, Rabbi, when did you come here? How did you get here? Because the boat had left, and they knew he wasn't on it, and this is where during the night he had walked on the water to get back to the boat to his disciples, to the apostles, and finish the trip with them. He said, most assuredly, I say to you, you're not seeking me because you saw the signs, but because you were hungry, you ate the loaves, and you were filled. They wanted another miracle. Hey, if we could do this, we wouldn't have to work. We could eat without working. We could have plenty of food. But he told them, do not labor for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to everlasting life, which the Son of Man will give you, because God the Father has set his seal on him. They said, what shall we do to do these works, the works of God? The work of God, this is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he sent. That's our admonition as well. During these days of unleavened bread, that's what we're supposed to do, to believe in him who the Father has sent. In verse 31, they brought up the fact that their fathers had ate the manna in the desert, and but he gave them bread from heaven. They thought that's what Christ was going to do here, but that's not what Christ was doing, not what Christ was saying. In verse 35, Jesus Christ makes one of the most important statements that he made in the entire book, in the entire four Gospels. Jesus said to them, that group of people, I am the bread of life. I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst. Now, he didn't just say this once. He stated it three times in this chapter. He said it again in verse 48. I am the bread of life. I am the living bread, he said, which comes down from heaven. He said that in verse 51. And he gives the formula for us to have that bread living in us. Verse 63, he said, it is the Spirit that gives life. It is the Spirit that gives life. That's the formula, that we take in Jesus Christ and his Spirit lives in us, and we try to do the things to make that Spirit grow. We try to eliminate as much of the sin and filth and dirt out of our life as we can and have Jesus Christ live in us. He said, the words that I speak to you are spirit and they are life. Those words are spirit and they are life. They help us to continue to grow. Romans 6 and in verse 1. Romans 6 and in verse 1. We'll read 1 to 4. It would help if I went to Romans, I guess. It says in verse 1, shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? Certainly not. How shall we who died to sin live any longer in it? Or do you not know that as many of us as were baptized into Jesus Christ were baptized into his death? When we were baptized and had hands laid on us is when the Spirit of God entered in. The Spirit of Jesus Christ and God the Father entered into us. And that's how we take Christ in, through his Spirit and through him living in us. Therefore, in verse 4, we were buried with him through baptism into death, that just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, even so also we should walk in newness of life. When we became baptized, we made that covenant and we promised that we would follow Jesus Christ through thick and thin, for better or worse. We made a marriage covenant with Jesus Christ that we would do his will and we would no longer do our own will. We would walk in sincerity and truth and not with malice and wickedness. So again, as we ask the question, what does this mean? What does this mean? Let's go to 2 Corinthians, the 6th chapter. 2 Corinthians 6. We'll start in verse 14. And as we read this, let's see, or let's think about, should we be celebrating Christ's death and Christ's, the Passover and the unleavened bread like the people of the world, the Christian world who proclaims to do it through Easter? Keep that in mind. Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers, for what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? What communion has light with darkness? What accord has Christ with Satan or Belial? Or what part has a believer with an unbeliever? What agreement has the temple of God with idols? For we are temples of the living God, as God has said. What part do we have in idols? We shouldn't have. Or in idolatrous practices, things that that people do that come from paganry and from idolatry. I will dwell in him, as God has said, I will dwell in them and walk among them. I will be their God and they shall be my people. Therefore, come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will receive you. I will be a father to you, and you shall be my sons and daughters, says the Lord Almighty. Therefore, verse 1 of chapter 7, having these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all unfilthiness of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness, and here it is, in the fear of God. Why are we doing this? To learn to fear our God always. To learn to fear our God always. And here he repeats it. Perfecting holiness in the fear of God. That's why we're doing this. God has made these appointments for us to come to him, to keep these appointments with him, to learn, to teach us, to learn to fear him always, and it's for our good. 25 to 30 years after the crucifixion, why did Paul say for them to keep the feast in 1 Corinthians 5? A Gentile church, and he's telling them, keep the feast. And he mentions the Passover and leaven and unleavened, that we may learn to remove wickedness, which is sin, and that we may learn to take in the truth, the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth, the bread of life, which is Jesus Christ. That's why we're doing this. That's why we're not following what others are doing, most others, and celebrating Easter bunnies and colored eggs and sunrise services and all kinds of weird candies. We are doing it that we can learn to take in the bread of life, which is Jesus Christ in us. Leviticus 23:6 says, 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. And I encourage us to take it to heart. And when we do that, to realize why we're eating this hard bread that is not as good as some of the, you know, it's not as good as a McDonald's fish sandwich. But it's for our good always. That's why. One last scripture, Deuteronomy 14:23. And I think we've already been there. Deuteronomy 14 and verse 23. But it bears repeating. Deuteronomy 14 and in verse 23. It says again, "You shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide the tithes of your grain and your new wine and your oil, of the firstborn of your herds and your flocks, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always."